you're running RF. That's a propagation sometimes is a little bit faster and make more money. So there's money instantaneous transmission of information. And also, we've talked about it in the past, that using entangled particles, using quantum encryption, you can transfer information with little to no risk of people hearing you and breaking in. One of the ways to people is the person in the middle type of where they squat listening in the land and they bleed out and listening in a quantum entangled encryption key. Once you collapse the wave function, it collapsed. And so everyone online knows that their security has been breached. So there's a lot of things that can be monetized for this this interesting quirk of nature.
Thanks for this key. I found one of the articles, two or three articles, pending with a reputation of diamonds, small diamonds. And I found on Wikipedia, quantum teleportation, it's a title from Wikipedia, the free encyclopedia. And the third paragraph from staff, and it says, year 1997, Sandu Popescu and Anton Zellinger. And I'm trying to find out which university was that, but quantum teleportation had been made, including photons, atoms, electrons, and superconducting circuits, as well as the distance of 1.4 kilometers, 1,400 kilometers, which would be 870 miles, being the longest distance of successful teleportation by the group of Chan Wei Tan, using Micus satellites for space-based quantum teleportation. Challenges first in quantum teleportation include no cloning theorem, which set the limitation that creating an exact copy of quantum state is impossible. Let me drop. The leading theorem that states that quantum information cannot be destroyed. The size of the information teleported, the amount of quantum information the sender or receiver has before teleportation, and noise the teleportation system has within its circuitry. But the statement stands about photons, atoms, and electrons. So at least this one could be easy to find. Again, the title is Quantum Teleportation by Wikipedia. I'll take care.
Wesley, do me a favor. Read the first sentence in that page.
Quantum teleportation is a technique for transferring quantum information for the sender at one location to a receiver some distance away. What teleportation is commonly portrayed in a science fiction as a means of transferring physical objects from one location to the next. Quantum teleportation only transfers quantum information. I agree. An important note is that the sender knows near the location, nor the recipient, nor quantum state that will be transferred. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? I agree with you 100%, but isn't that amazing? Interesting.
Yes, it's amazing. Einstein, it makes little sense to me. It brings the question fundamental concepts of physics, locality. We have this innate real need to think of the fact that you have to be near something to affect it. You can't affect it from afar. I mean, you can use intermediaries between the two, but that's just displacing locality. And the loss of locality is really annoying to almost everyone. There are some people who try to use the concept of hidden variables to explain this. Bell's theorem kind of dismisses that. And there's lots of books on the subject. And again, everyone out there could end up with a nosebleed if I go into it that much farther. But it is a fascinating aspect of physics and the universe in general.
Now, let me go a little bit further and use your expertise, or at least your opinion, if I could say so. We have upcoming 5G, and then we talk about the new means of information sharing that could be done through satellite too. What is the future of 5G compared to that? Or maybe I'm simply lost in space and switching.
I'm not exactly sure what you're getting at. 5G is a technology for cellular phones. It uses a much wider bandwidth and a lot more repeaters in order to make a much wider bandwidth for a lot more data to be sent back and forth and all over the place, so that everyone is connected to the internet and everyone, for some reason, can watch a 4K movie on their cell phone. It, to my knowledge, doesn't implement any really incredible new technology per se. It's using QAM like it always used QAM, quadrature amplitude modulation in one way or another, but it's a matter of extending the frequency range of the technology that's going to increase the symbol rate or the bandwidth.
Of the two sources that I was quoting, one was the teleportation from Wikipedia was done using solar. So, and it was 1993. So we're talking about something that is right now being said as new, very much old thought and experiment that was done many years ago. Then we're talking since we not necessarily attached to the fiber optic, and we could do it through satellite, and the information is bit, and bits are using our computer, and we could hear the voice that is actually converted from digital to analog, and it can appear on our speaker as well. And we can listen to the music, and we can see more news and whatever. Now, could quantum bits be employed to perform or to means of our communication as the meaning that we see the traditional technology to be done? And that's why I mentioned 5G and the future of 5G when we have such revelations. As I remember, I was young when my father, who was teaching physics, mathematics, and chemistry, tried to find me one teacher. One teacher. In the entire United States of America and entire United Europe. Right now, you can teach 3% in the university. Let me go. I was in that smart. So, you're telling me about television that could be TV sets that could be hung on the wall. And he said it's going to come. And he was trying to explain to me how he see it may happen. And it happened. But the question is, the two words, the words of respect that I have for you, thank you for letting me hear. What do you think, if you could stretch your imagination, just stretch your imagination, is it possible that 2G could actually replace 5G or any G, whatever the G, because now they are imposed into certain applications, and so it's
as I tried to mention to him that quantum mechanics makes it difficult to systematically do it, and what inevitably happens is over time, entangled pairs unentangled, and so their information is not the same as the original information, and basically corrupted without, and you don't know when it gets corrupted, because unless you can transfer some information from the other site through classical means, you can't check the validity for your results. So that's one problem. That's why you only get 19% of quantum entangled responses that pan out. Quantum to David about 64 billion bits to 128 billion bits, and these quantum computers at best 65 bits entirely. Hello. 5G, like any other radio propagation system, you are sending photons, the photons have information, the photons are received. Getting the photons a fraction of a second, and entangling all those next 100 years, I think it's incredibly improbable. It's simply, there's too many limitations, and there's not enough monetary need for it. So I think people are going to be using regular radio propagation transmissions and not entangling photons, electrons, or even diamonds. And I'll tell you what, Wesley, since I record these things in case Mike over at amateurradio.tv is I will send you mine with the benefit that whatever I say is local and you can hear every word that I say. How's that?
Absolutely beautiful.
You're welcome, Wesley. Okay, that was fun. You got to do that again. Once again, I want to remind people, if you have any questions, if you have any topics, if you have any puzzles, no one sent me puzzles for months and months and months, unfortunately. And if you want me to tap Paul on the shoulder and ask him to take a look at something space-related, the email address that you can reach me is mailbag@alphacharlie2golfsierra.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. Links are available. There's a lot of interesting links tonight. go look at them when you have a chance after Paul has done his stuff. You can find that at roy.ac2gs.com. I stream audio of this to everyone, so that if you want to hear what it sounds like from my chat, if you don't have a radio, if you have a friend who would just like to listen in and they're not a ham, I keep this link open 24/7. So anyone interested in listening into WTVL, just point your browser at technet.ac2gs.com and you can hear its audio stream. And I always like to remind people of MikeKC2NJI, who maintains a wonderful archive of these technical nets on his website, amateurradio.tv. He's been keeping records, audio copies of these nets since September of 2006, so please avail yourself of it. So once again, want to thank everyone who participated tonight. And Paul, WS2N, is here now with the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS, WS2N. Very good, Roy. And, you know, if you notice there's too many cracklies as I'm transmitting, you know, if we have to come to a grinding halt, that's okay. You know, just let me know when I unkey. And that's it. There's nothing we can do about it. It's only 7 miles. The weather, so I don't know what the problem is, but it's very intermittent. Some transmissions get so far very good, and every now and then it's very, you know, some copy, and that goes on, you know, on everybody's thing. But you've been doing that pretty good, Roy, just to let you know. Let me drop it. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet.
You sounded good, Paul.
Okay, I got my beam pointed right down the throat of Selman, so. No, it's not going to be power. Okay, very good. I usually start off with the most popular launches for the week. And a few hours before this TechNet, there was a company that put their first rocket into orbit, successfully made it after a number of tries over the last couple of years. This is Virgin Orbital, and it's the same company owned by Richard Branson, also. Passengers on a spacecraft to suborbital launches, but you know, about 10 years ago, he came up with the idea to also put small payloads into orbit as well. And he thought about flying it on the carrier jet that he does use for Spaceship Two, that will carry people to space. But then he dropped that idea years ago, and he came up with the idea of using one of his 747 Virgin Orbital is, you know, it's also part of Richard Branson's company. He's got the airplane company. So he took one of his old jets that he wasn't using anymore, put a name on the side of it called Cosmic Girl, and he decided that he's going to launch 70-foot-long rockets from the bottom of the from one of the wings on the port wing. So get up to 35,000 feet or so, drop the rocket when the plane is heading up on a 20-degree angle, so the plane is crashing into the rocket. He's got four people on board the plane, you know, pilot, co-pilot, two engineers. So actually, it's almost like four people are riding the first stage of a booster, of a rocket. So he's eliminating that first stage by having this airplane, and then the airplane will come back and land on, you know, wherever it came from. In this case, Mojave, California. So anyway, the plane took off today, and got out over the Pacific, started heading south, with the airplane and drop the name of the rocket. It's called Launcher 1. It's fancy, but it's called Launcher 1 rocket. And Orbit 1 got his own engines that he made. They're called Newton engines. Newton engine fired. It's a liquid fired engine. It's liquid kerosene, liquid oxygen. You know, over many tries over the last couple of years, this one was finally successful. And it started heading south, going to go into a polar orbit, heading over Antarctica. First stage separates from that rocket. Another new engine ignites, and it takes it to orbit. Wasn't a circular orbit yet. He had to wait about 45 minutes, and then the engine reignited again to put it into a 500 kilometer, or roughly 300 miles high orbit, in a polar orbit. And he launched 10 satellites in this, with his first launch, 10 CubeSats. And for different, different schools, different groups that make these things. They've been launching CubeSat for quite a few years now, probably about 20 years. But, one of the CubeSats is called AMSAT Vanderbilt RAD FX SAT 2 / Fox 1E. Fox 1E part is an amateur radio sat. It's part of the same satellite, but it's part of the amateur radio. So what you have is a transponder with an uplink on 2 meters, downlink on 70 cents. So uplink is 145.860 to 145.890. So if you transmit it anywhere in between that, it will come down somewhere between 435.760 megahertz and 435.790 megahertz.
FM.
So, I mean, and it's a small satellite. You got no idea. I couldn't believe that they put all this up. And there's another reason for the satellite. Testing our other equipment for Vanderbilt University as they constructed this thing. On board, it's got two whip antennas, one for 2 meters, one for 70 centimeters. It has three NICAD batteries. I'm surprised to see the NICAD batteries in this thing. But, you know, they'll be constantly recharged by solar cells. This cube is completely covered by solar cells. It weighs around 5 pounds of satellite. By the way, CubeSat, they have different designations, you know, 1U, 2U, 3U. 1U is one unit, so one unit of a CubeSat is 10 centimeters cube. It's actually, so it's four inches. 4 inches on each side. You can see that it's 4 inches. 4-inch cube. And this cube, they have six boards that are located, one right on top of the other, filled with electronic micro components. From what I understand, one of those boards is dedicated to the amateur radio part of it. So that's pretty cool, and it was put up by the first successful launch of orbital Virgin Orbit. Virgin Orbital first launch, successful launch for that rocket, cool launcher, Launcher 1. It has the capability of putting up a little over 1,000 pounds into orbit. So now he plans on doing this on a regular basis. He stole the idea in a way from NASA. NASA has launched a little over 40 of these types of rockets where they take a, for NASA's case, a Pegasus rocket, which is not liquid fuel, it's a solid booster rocket, and they put it you're on the bottom of a jumbo jet. And they were using with, I guess, 20 years, 40 different launches of jumbo jet, Lockheed L-1011. And that used to be a competitor against the 747. You know, where you still see a million 747s flying around, you don't see any L-1011s. This is the last one that's flying. I think it's going to be eventually phased out, especially now with this company taking over. They can do it naturally a lot cheaper. But, you know, they've come a long way with small satellite launches. We have Rocket Lab down in New Zealand launching the Electron rocket for single launch satellites or multiple launch satellites, similar to what they did here. You have Astron, is another one. Astra rocket, which is almost ready to be successful. They've launched twice, and each time they get closer and closer to make it to orbit. They launched out of Kodiak, out of Alaska. Once they become successful, they'll be able to join the group. Then a little larger rocket, which sort of a medium lift rocket, is Firefly, Firefly Aerospace. They'll be joining the group probably within 2 years. Let me drop in for any questions before I move on. This is WS2X. Okay, then another launch to watch will be this week. Sometime this week, I don't have the date yet, but they don't have the date. We'll be by SpaceX. They're going to try another experimental test with the Starship that they're building down in Boca Chica, Texas. And they plan on launching another test flight to 10 kilometers high, you know, the number 6 miles high. So they plan on doing this. Their predicted date is will be this Tuesday. So we'll look for it on Tuesday, and if it gets up that high, we'll eventually kick over and do like a body flop all the way down through the atmosphere, and then hopefully when it gets near the landing pad back in Texas, it will ignite its three engines, or actually, you know, one of the three engines two of the three engines will reignite to land on a landing pad. It was almost successful in doing it about a month ago, with SN8 and SN9. SN8 went up successfully, the first launch of three Raptor engines put together with 415,000 pound engines each one. So he was delivering, you know, over a million pounds of thrust, almost a million and a half pounds of thrust. And it got up to the same height. Got plans on going this week and successfully tilted over. And when it came back, came all the way back, reignited the engine. Everything was going smooth. And then it wound up crashing, blowing up on the launch pad. But he was very happy with the results. And when I say he, I mean Elon Musk. SpaceX. He got a lot of data back, and that was okay. Figured out what the problem was. Figured out the fuel tank. We call it the header fuel tank collapsed. He didn't have enough internal pressure. This time he's going to add helium to the to that tank, and this way the tank will not collapse or explode. You know, as your fuel gets rushed out, it creates a vacuum inside the tank. Too much of the vacuum collapses the tank, and it runs out of fuel and explodes. So he got that corrected. We'll see how that goes on Tuesday. Drop it. Now NASA is trying to get ready with their large engines. The engine I was just talking about is 450, let's go 500,000 pounds of thrust, and a half million pounds of thrust in that category. NASA has engines that they've been using for decades on the shuttle, and they're called RS-25 engines, and they're a little over that, about 550,000 pounds of thrust. And when the space shuttle went up, they would put three on the space shuttle, and they used two gigantic solid boosters, one on the port side, one on the starboard side. And when it went up, the two boosters would separate, and then it would continue on to orbit using the same three engines. The RS-25, one with 550,000 pounds each. And that would continue to orbit. To do that, those engines had a line light on the ground. Continue to orbit, it would take 8 minutes from ground to orbit. So the big boosters would separate a little over 2 minutes after launch. But those three engines had to keep going for the 8 minutes. So now what NASA is planning to do is eventually they're going to be launching the SLS system. They plan on launching the first rocket, the SLS, at the end of this year, 2021. And the idea is launching a massive rocket with the second stage on top and another service module above that. Above that, the Orion spacecraft, which will eventually hold four astronauts. They're going to put this whole stack together, and including a launch port system on top of the Orion spacecraft. And they plan on launching this at the end of the year without a crew. Go around the moon, orbit the moon, eventually deorbit the moon, and come back home to test flight. But to get off the launch pad, they need to test these engines. Now, instead of having three liquid fuel engines, RS-25 engines, they're taking the exact same engines. In fact, some of them flew before on the shuttle. The shuttles came back and took the engines, refurbished them, made them a little bit more powerful, brought them up to 109% efficiency. They put four on the bottom of the main tank, the main first stage. So they call it the core stage. They put the core stage, 220-foot thing, four engines on bottom, and they bolted it in to a test stand down in Mississippi, Venice, Mississippi, which is not too far from New Orleans, but to give you an idea where it is. And that's where this testing facility is. You know, NASA has used it for years. So they brought it down, put it in a 30-story structure, and they're finally going to test it. They actually bought the whole setup there almost a year ago. It's taken them that long to get ready for this. Build it up with all liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. That's the fuel that they use, same as what they have with the shuttle. And lit it off today. yesterday, correct. I sat there and watched it on the NASA channel, and it was pretty cool. The smoke that comes out of here, and the smoke is really nothing but steam. When hydrogen and oxygen ignite, the exhaust is actually steam. It covered like for a mile or so, the trees are covered with this stuff. As it's blowing out, they say the roar of course is incredible. So we got down to a little over a minute, and the engines were supposed to start testing. They were going to try gimbling, moving the engines a little bit here and there. They didn't get that far. They heard one engine shut down, or the mission control say that. And then next thing you know, all four of them shut down. 2 minutes out of the air. The rockets, which I'm sure they're very happy about. And apparently, they said there was a main component problem. What it is, I don't know, it's more of the turbos that let loose or something. Not severe, because there was no explosion, right? Some kind of breakage inside that thing. Now they have to eventually figure it out. Look at the computer logs and eventually dig down to whatever the problem is and repair it. Maybe it's a broken valve or whatever it might be. So repair it. It's all, only one of the engines. And I'm sure they'll probably run another test. The earliest they would be able to do this again would be about another month from now. Would it delay the upcoming launch to the moon, scheduled for the end of the year? My guess is probably will. So I'm going to go with early 2022 for the first unmanned launch. The hardware and everything is duplicating this. Another spacecraft and all that. They go through a whole process of duplication. And that should come, you know, probably another 6 months later or so. They plan on launching a crew to the moon, around the moon, not land on the moon, but again, they'll have a crew of four people duplicating what this one will do. And eventually return to Earth. The next mission after that, as it's planned now, is actually the exact same thing. It's crew, this time actually land on the moon. We'll see when that happens. The earliest date will be 2024. I'm going with 2026 for the earliest date. Any comments or questions? WS2N for the space portion of the Tech Man. Okay, go to AR1. AR1 is another engine that was being built and now it's ready for testing. Completed by a company called Aerojet Rocketdyne. Aerojet Rocketdyne has been around, as far as I'm concerned, it's got 20, 30 years. They've been around a long time and they've been building these, they built engines for NASA. The engines I was talking about, the RS-25, the NASA, they are planning on building this other engine, AR-1, Aerojet Rocketdyne number 1, and this is going to be a brand new 500,000 pound engine. The idea was to replace the Russian engine. Back then, about 5-6 years ago, they plan on building the AR-1, which is going to be a liquid kerosene with an oxygen engine. That they plan on, they had plans of replacing on the Atlas rocket that NASA launched successfully about almost 80 times. Plan was to get rid of the RD-180, the Russian engine. Then NASA said somewhere along that time frame when that plan went into effect, well, we have the Vulcan engine we're building, Vulcan rocket boat that we're building to replace the Atlas V, very successful Atlas V rocket. Vulcan was the replacement for what we need an engine. Actually, we need two engines. So this thing was produced over 1 million pounds of thrust for this new rocket that was developed for the Vulcan. And then as time went on, NASA said, well, you know, we have a choice. We can either go with the AR-1, or we can go with the new engine that Blue Origin is building. Blue Origin is a company owned by Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos, of course, is one of the richest guys in the world. He owns Amazon. He has his own company called Blue Origin. And he's also building another massive rocket similar to this. And it's called the B-4. B-4 is going to be producing over 500 pounds of thrust like this. The B-4 is an introduction. It's been being constructed about 3 years earlier in design than the AR-1. So it was further along. So NASA decided to go with the B-4 engine, so two of them. Again, it'll be, you know, 550,000 pounds of thrust, two engines. Put that into a brand new Vulcan engine. Atlas V, they're just going to retire that rocket. So that will be the design, Vulcan and two BE-4s. Now, what happens to the new AR-1? That aerojet has spent a fortune, you know, probably $1 billion, but a lot of money to develop. They have no rockets for it. Turns out there's another copy I mentioned earlier, and that's called Firefly. Firefly is building rockets, but they did not have an engine for their rocket that they designed. So they, instead of two engines, we just want one of these engines, because we're a medium lift rocket company. They haven't launched anything, but they expect maybe at the end of the year to do this. To that, plan on launching out of Vandenberg Air Force for its base in California. So they've made a deal with Aerojet Rocketdyne to use the AR-1. So it's got a home, it's got a place to go. So it wasn't for nothing. That's what they went through. All the engineers, mechanics, they'll be able to continue on and build new ones. These are not reusable engines. The plan was to have these expendable engines in the future. Could they be reused? There is some talk of actually hooking parachutes up to the lower end of the engine section of the rocket. Most expensive part of the rocket. So they plan on, maybe just having the first stage go into the drink and actually recover the AR-1 or the BE-4s that Blue Origin is building. So that's an update on the rockets. Looks like we have a good future for small, medium, and heavy lift rockets in the United States, WS1. Any questions or comments? I don't know if Echo Link is up and running. Well, static. I've been on the key for a while. We'll try it again. Or do you see anybody on Echo Link tonight?
Yeah, there are people on it. No one's tried to transmit, so I think you're good for tonight.
Okay, thank you. Okay, here's one other interesting thing that came along. Anybody that goes to the NASA site probably saw this. They're talking about the sound from Mars. Plan on actually hearing sound from Mars after the Perseverance 2020 rover lands in Jezero crater on Mars. And that will be happening February 18th. Of course, microphones will be on. Won't get any transmission for a couple of days. Information will be stored on flash drives and eventually relayed back through the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, which is flying overhead in orbit around Mars. And from there, it gets transmitted back on the X-band to space network on Earth. Mars rover's got so many things when it gets there. It's got all kinds of weather equipment when it lands on Mars. It's got drilling equipment. It's got all kinds of cameras. 23 cameras. The older Curiosity has 17 cameras. So the thing will ride around on Mars. Essentially, using core borer. Not pulverized anything, but it's got to take pieces out of rock, cache them. Store them either on the body of the rover itself, or maybe you can just leave them behind, and to eventually be picked up by a future lander. Helicopter bolted on the bottom of the body of the essentially disconnected. We'll sit on the planet. Rover will move away. Helicopter by itself. Helicopter even has the ingenuity will fly through the air and take a beautiful picture. Hopefully perseverance.
Away from the rock, 20 feet away from the rock, and then
digital echo through the spectrograph, dimensional and information sent back to Earth, figure out what kind of rocket is, what kind of material it is zapping. But, and they'll also have the audio from it. So that's pretty exciting. You know, as a ham, I like to hear things in the CW, of course, people's voices, background noise. And here we'll be able to hear the sounds of Mars. Any comments or questions? WS for the space portion of the TechNet.
Paul?
Like you, Roy. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to tell you a few things. The glimpse for Peter died 2-3 minutes, about 10 minutes ago, but now it sounds fine. Frank, WB2BXO, that to get through the echo link is such is keeping the repeater alive to the up. By a somewhat longer pause and see if Frank can get through.
Okay, I'll pause for WB2BXL. Roy, I hit a crack in Frank as well. We try. Frank, are you out there? WS2.
I am now with all the crackly stuff that's continuing in the repeater. It's not your fault for some of the crackly stuff trying to get in. I just wanted to make a couple of comments about the so-called DCL1 signal when you get to it, the B2BX stuff.
Okay, Frank, you want to make a couple of comments about question marks, that part I just missed. What's the topic?
The signal we talked about last week, the 980.002 megahertz breakthrough listen candidate, I said it wrong, the LC1 signal, I believe it's called. I think Roy and I discussed it last week, but we may have already signed off. Go ahead.
Okay, that was the, that was the signal. They're trying to figure out if it had modulation on it or not. Is that the one?
Yeah, correct. That's the one, yeah. There's another very interesting video on it this week just to debunk it. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. You know, if you have a video or something like that, you can probably send it over to Roy's website. Eventually we'll take a look at it. He's pretty good at posting that type of thing. But, I haven't read anything new since last week on that, or the week before. But, we'll look for that. Frank, back to you.
Yeah, very good. Gotta keep waiting for the noise team to repeat it or drop. Yeah, essentially, and I can find the link and send it. John Michael Gauthier, the Event Horizon channel, interviewed Avi Loeb, who one of Roy's favorite people, who this time kind of debunked it. He said the Doppler shift is wrong, it doesn't match with Proxima B, which was the direction it seems to be coming from. What were the other reasons he said it? Also, just the fact that it was so close to exactly 980 megahertz, It was doubtful it was alien because aliens would have a different time base. So 980 megahertz wouldn't be an exact frequency to them in all likelihood. And third of all, so I don't think he went into details. He had said that some devices have been found which have oscillators that operate on that frequency with a slight drift. So it might have been reflections for them. So there were at least three reasons why Dr. Loeb seems to be debunking this already. Go ahead.
Okay, Frank, very good. Oh, boy, that would be thrilling if it was, you know, some kind of a beacon or something set up by an alien group, but to assume it's going to be the closest star to Earth, that happens to be, you know, so close, of course, chances are. Not really, but what we, you know, we do have to eventually figure out exactly what it is. And as long as they can get that repeating signal every now and then, that's all they would need. Eventually, they would be able to figure out what it is. Of course, I don't believe it's going to be intelligent life, but I believe it's going to be detected and figured out. Right.
Yeah, unfortunately, it sounds like this one is going to be discounted fairly quickly, and unlike the WOW signal, it sounds like they have enough data to figure out relatively easily what terrestrial source it is from. Disappointing. It would be nice if this one proved out, but it doesn't sound like it's going to prove out this time. Though, I think it's apparently some people feel it shows that the breakthrough listening methodology has some validity in being able to detect signals and discount them anyway. All right, enough of that. At least get off topic as to where you are, but thanks for letting me in here. WB2BX, so I'll be listening for a bit.
Okay, thanks for all of that, Frank. And, you know, you're not crapping at all, so I, you know, and you can cure the problem. unless this repeater, yeah, you're coming through the same repeater I'm using. Maybe that was okay. But I know Andy will have a ball with it, so will Lou. Trying to, you know, I mean, we've heard the crappies before. It will be straightened out, sure. Another good thing I was going to mention is the Starship I was talking about earlier. That's the one that being built by SpaceX to eventually send people not only to the moon but to Mars. Elon Musk has this fantasy with actually eventually someday going to Mars himself. But to do that, he needs to build not hundreds, maybe 1,000 of these starships. He believes he could drive the cost of launching these things down tremendously. Right now, he launches the Falcon 9 almost regularly, sometimes a couple of times a month. And about, you know, Falcon 9 costs roughly $62 million some years ago to launch one of these things. The cost is coming down because he keeps reusing the first stage. And now he reuses the clamshell bearings that also come off the rocket. They come back on parachutes, and he captures them with these large boats floating around in the ocean and brings them back to Earth. Sends them back up again, reuses everything. The only thing he doesn't reuse is the second stage. mean, even the spacecraft, the manned spacecraft that goes to the International Space Station, they're being reused. The cargo vehicles have been being reused. They've gotten a couple of uses out of the older version. Now he's sending up the newer version, which will have even more uses out of the cargo version. So, you know, he's got this deal where the new starships, which are, you know, I mean, the idea of, you have to get, you know, to give you an idea, the Falcon 9 launches with roughly a little over 2 million pounds, roughly 2.1 million pounds thrust.